I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, we continue our series of conversations with the candidates with Susan Turnbull, the Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor. She's running with former NAACP President Ben Jealous, who's trying to unseat a very popular incumbent, Republican Larry Hogan. Susan Turnbull brings to the ticket a pedigree steeped in state and national politics. She chaired the Maryland Democratic Party for 2 years, and she served in several leadership positions in the Democratic National Committee. She is the co-founder of Emerge Maryland, an organization that trains women to run for public office, and she's a former member of the Montgomery County Board of Appeals. Susan Turnbull, she's my guest when Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for hanging with us this afternoon. Today, it's another installment in our series of conversations with the candidates. Susan Turnbull has been active behind the scenes of the Democratic Party for years, and now she is stepping out front as the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor, running alongside former NAACP President Ben Jealous. Susan Turnbull served as the chair of the Maryland Democratic Party from 2009 to 2011. Prior to that, she was vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. She also chaired the DNC Women's Committee in the late 90s and early 2000s, and she led the DNC's Women's Leadership Forum. Susan Turnbull is a co-founder of Emerge Maryland, an organization that offers training to women who want to run for elective office. She also served on the Montgomery County Board of Appeals. In addition to her work in politics, she has also been very active in Jewish service organizations, including co-founding the Bolshoi Jewish Heritage Society and serving on the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Washington. She holds a bachelor's degree in urban studies from the University of Cincinnati, and she has run an interior design firm and a firm that consults with members of Congress for the past many years. Susan Turnbull is 65 years old. She and her husband Bruce live in Bethesda. They have two adult children and three grandchildren. We will take your calls and comments a little later in the program. You can ping us on Facebook right now. We are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page. Ms. Turnbull, it's a delight to meet you.
It's great to be here. And it was fun talking to you before the show started, because one of the things that became clear is that in addition to what you just read about me, there's other things that you didn't know. I have worked, I'm a retired federal employee. I worked for members of Congress for the last 11 years, but a total of 15 years. And the other thing that I found sort of interesting is that I came to Maryland to go to graduate school. I stayed in Maryland. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and I came to the University of Maryland
in the 70s.
In
right?
the 70s,
yeah. And long time.
And met my husband working on Capitol Hill, and we've as you said, I raised a family here in Maryland.
Yeah. So politics has certainly been part of your DNA for a long time. But as
yes.
I mentioned, it's kind of behind the scenes, you know, on the Hill and working as a consultant and in the DNC, in the Maryland Democratic Party. The conversation you had with Ben Jealous when he approached you about being his lieutenant governor. Tell us about that conversation and why did you accept his offer?
It was really interesting, Tom. When I met with Ben, it was after I had actually committed to support another candidate because I didn't know Ben. And I came home from my very first meeting with Ben and I said to my husband, he's speaking at a different level. The issues that he wants to talk to are on a different plane, and I really like what he has to say. Our first conversation, we had talked about what both of us had in our background. For Ben, it was being the former head of the NAACP and bringing groups together and building coalitions. And for me, most recently, I chaired two major national Jewish organizations, Jewish Women International and the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, which is an umbrella organization of 125 Jewish community relations councils across the country and 17 major national Jewish organizations. And we had worked on things together. We, while Ben was doing certain things at the NAACP, these other organizations were working on some of the same projects, like environmental justice, working on issues for women, over the years. And so we had this really fascinating conversation. He also talked to me about college affordability. And as I just told you, I came to Maryland to go to graduate school. I came to Maryland, the University of Maryland, largely because I became a graduate assistant and I could afford to do that. My dad was an immigrant cab driver in Cleveland. My mom worked at a department store at a minimum wage, just pennies above it. And so when I sat down with Ben talking to him about college affordability, which was something he was at that point in the campaign talking about a lot, it hit me to the core because it also said, how are my kids going to pay for their children? How are my grandchildren? When we had had those conversations with our kids and we realized that no matter how much people save today, they're never going to be able to afford it. And so when Ben and I sat down and we talked about things, we talked about healthcare. I had a healthcare issue with my family growing up. My father passed away 35 years ago, and my mom shortly thereafter. And in both cases, the issues about their healthcare were things that really, the cost of healthcare was something that really made a difference. And so hearing Ben's goal for Medicare for All and his goal for making sure that we fully fund our schools and make our schools number one again, those issues, it was all about the issues. And then personal chemistry, obviously. And so it was, if not now, when, in my case. I've been involved in politics in Maryland since 1982, statewide since 1986.
But never thought about elective office until now, or did you?
Exactly. I hadn't thought about it. I had once toyed with it about 10 years ago when there seemed to be an opening that never became an open seat, and I chose not to run. But what, for me, Ben describes it this way, I helped pave the way for other women. I worked behind the scenes, and I encouraged them to make that decision. So when someone came to me and said, you should run, in 2017, when we had seen what happened in the previous election, and we had seen how women across this country have basically taken the bull by the horns and said, it is our turn. We can bring something new and different into this. How could I not?
The current governor and lieutenant governor entered the race 4 years ago with no prior elective experience, a little bit of experience in government. Mm-hmm. You and Mr. Jealous also no prior elective office experience. Mm-hmm. The voters didn't seem to mind about that 4 years ago. I wonder if the voters think differently about it now, given the fact that the president of the United States also came into office without any elective experience. And that experience for many people, particularly in our state, many Democrats across the country, has been less than ideal. I mean, does experience in elective office, in a state legislature, in the House of Delegates, in some capacity in Annapolis, matter to doing this job?
Well, Ben and I have worked at all levels of government. I've worked from city council I was Brian Frosch's first chief of staff when he was elected to the House of Delegates. So I worked in the House of Delegates. I've worked in Congress. Ben and I have specialized in getting big things done. And what Ben did in Maryland in 2012 when he was head of the NAACP was bring people together to make government more accountable and to get big things done. That's why he was named Marylander of the Year in 2013. He worked to help repeal the death penalty. He made sure that that there were votes on the floor and in the referendum, bringing communities together for marriage equality. And he co-led the DREAM Act in Maryland, giving opportunity to everyone. No one thought one of those things could get done, but he worked with the legislature. He worked with the leaders of the legislature and our then sitting governor to make sure those things happened. I have no doubt that is something that people are going to want in experience. What they want too is inspiration. What Ben is offering us and what I hope to be offering our state is looking at an issue and solving people's problems. We want to make sure that our education system is number one again. It has fallen to sixth. We want to make sure that there is access to available quality health care for everyone all the time, regardless of where they're working, regardless of their employer. And the premiums having gone up about, in some cases, up to 120% on average on certain premiums.
And are there areas like healthcare, like education, affordability, that Ben Jealous has talked to you about spearheading in particular? In other words, your notion of the job. I mean, Governor Hogan has said to Mr. Rutherford, I want you to head the opioid crisis task force. I want you to do some things, you know, in a couple of other things, a senior citizens commission that he heads. Are there things in particular that would be in your purview as Lieutenant Governor?
Well, we've talked a lot of things. First of all, I think it's always really important to recognize that the Lieutenant Governor will be working in partnership with the governor, and that's the only way that it works in our state. And we've seen when it hasn't worked in our state. That's number one. What the specific issues, one of the things that became very important to me was the issue of seniors. My parents weren't seniors very long, but their life as seniors was really difficult. As I mentioned, my father passed away 35 years ago, and from the day my father passed away until for the next 9 years, my mother had a very serious illness. My mom had something like Lou Gehrig's disease. It wasn't Lou Gehrig's disease, but it had a lot of the same manifestations. My mom lived in a nursing home for 7 years. During those years in a nursing home, because she couldn't get care otherwise, and during those years in the nursing home, she was never treated for preventive health care of any sort. It was all about her physical disabilities, and so she was never screened for breast cancer. 7 years into her residency at a nurse in a long-term care facility, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And immediately had surgery and died in recovery the night of surgery. So I came back to Maryland pretty distraught, as you can imagine, and I checked in with someone I knew who operated nursing homes, and I said to him, Harvey, how could this have happened? How could this have happened? Nobody noticed? And Harvey said to me, Susie, we don't do preventive health care in nursing homes. We don't do it in Maryland. We don't do it anywhere. And Brian Frosch and then-Senator Ida Rubin came to my house for a condolence call, and I told them that story. And they said, you know, Governor Donald Schaefer, you know, Governor Schaefer is really into preventive health care. Let me take you to see him. And so I went to see Governor Schaefer, and within 15 minutes, it may not have even been 15 minutes, he picks up the phone, he calls a woman named Adele Wizak, who was then head of the Nursing Home Association in Maryland, and said, we need to do something about this now. And he and I worked together with his staff to create a commission in Maryland to look at that issue. We looked at that issue, and a year later, on Mother's Day weekend in 1994, we announced from that day forward, women in nursing homes and men in nursing homes would be treated and screened for breast cancer and prostate cancer.
And that's still happening.
It's still happening. Mm-hmm. Every time, Tom, I walk into a facility here in Baltimore and Montgomery County, anywhere across the state, I ask the question.
Before we take a quick break, Mr. Hogan is described as a moderate Republican, and he has done his best to distance himself from the current president. This is a state that is a tradition of moderate Republicans. You think of the Connie Morellas of the world or Roscoe Bartletts of the world and many more. Is there a difference between a moderate Democrat and a moderate Republican? What does moderation mean in this era of incredible bifurcation in our politics?
I think that's very interesting. I mean, I listened to your interview with Boyd Rutherford, and his comment was, they have a tightrope. They have a tightrope. Well, this is not a circus. I mean, while it seems like a circus, it is not a circus. Right now, we have a governor who's been playing on that tightrope, who has said, "Okay, I don't support the president, but I do support the president. I I don't know how to respond. It is not moderate if you have vetoed legislation for education, for healthcare, for the environment. That is not moderate, no matter how you describe it. That is not moderate if you basically have not had the working relationship that he claims to have with our legislature. That's why our schools have fallen from first to sixth. That's why healthcare costs are up. And that's why our economy is stagnant.
Susan Turnbull is the Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor. She's on the ticket with former NAACP President Ben Jealous. We'll have more with Susan Turnbull, and we'll take your questions and comments when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page, where we are streaming our conversation from Studio A. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a conversation with April Ryan, who has covered the White House for the American Urban Radio Networks for more than 20 years. It's safe to say that covering the current administration has presented challenges unlike any others that she has encountered since she began at the White House covering Bill Clinton. She's got a new book. It's called Under Fire: Reporting from the Front Lines of the Trump White House. April joins me tomorrow to talk about it. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Dancing at Lunasa, the season opener at Baltimore's Everyman Theater. That's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Susan Turnbull. She's the former head of the Maryland Democratic Party. She also served in leadership positions with the Democratic National Committee. And now, for the first time, she is seeking elective office as the lieutenant governor candidate on the ticket with Ben Jealous. You are welcome to pose your questions and comments for Susan Turnbull, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, my mom thinks that's a great idea, @TomHallWYPR, and you can follow us on Facebook as well. You can catch us right now on the Facebook page at WYPR, where we are streaming live. Ms. Turnbull, let's go to a phone call. Leslie in Glen Arm, welcome to Midday with Susie Turnbull.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm very happy that Ms. Turnbull started the conversation regarding health care. And my question is specifically regarding oral health care. If you're able to look at the August 31st edition of the Baltimore Sun, there's an article entitled Dental Care is No Luxury. Adults, and especially in Maryland, have difficulty accessing oral health. There is a limited Medicaid oral health dental benefit. And as you know, poor oral health status impacts employability, military deployability, and quality of life. Nursing home access in terms of oral health care services is often limited. How would the Jealous administration address oral health equity and health equity in general in Maryland?
Thanks for the call, Leslie. Appreciate it.
Yeah, Leslie, it's really interesting that you asked that. This issue keeps coming up. And I was at a health fair in Prince George's County last month, and I will tell you that it is an issue that when you realize that Medicaid is not that the benefit is really limited. And in, for most people, their health care benefit for dental care is not there. That's a very serious situation. We talked to some medical providers who describe people in emergency rooms often are coming in because of infections that are developing in their jaws, in their up and more seriously, eventually, into their brain. It is very serious. And when I was there, I was thinking about this. When I was a little girl, as I explained, my dad was a cab driver. And I didn't have good dental care. So the year before I started college, I spent the summer at the dentist over and over and over again because it had not
making
been a
up
priority,
for lost time, huh?
Literally making up for lost time, and it had not been a priority. We see it as a priority. I've talked to people in the Western Maryland in Garrett County and on the Eastern Shore. The availability isn't there, and we have to fix that.
Let's talk a little bit about Mr. Jellis's and your proposals for affordable health care. It's one thing mm-hmm. to have health care be affordable for individual citizens, and it's another thing to have health care be affordable for the taxpayers of the state. There are many, and we'll talk to Mr. Jellis about this when he's back on the program next Tuesday. But as a general rule, I mean, are there paradigms? Are there states where this has worked? Because we certainly are aware of states where it has not worked. Vermont, California, they've tried state-run Medicare for All programs that have run into problems. What is step number one, and how can you assure folks that this is, in fact, affordable in terms of the budget of the state?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, what we are suggesting right now is to make sure that the Affordable Care Act, which is in existence, is as strong as possible. We want to make sure that the enrollment periods are there and that that will build our ability to make sure that the system is stable. The state has done things. The legislature has worked to make sure that some of our insurance it has been stable. But more importantly, we are an all-payer. We have an all-payer system, which means there are prices that are standard and consistent across the board. And so we're farther along than any other state has been. RAND has done a study. Others have done studies that Maryland, the size it is, could be a place where this could happen. What we want to do is start off for the first 2 years working with a commission, looking at every aspect of care, making sure that no one is left behind. But what we also know is staying in our current system, the way healthcare costs consistently rise, is the most expensive route. We have a very extensive plan. It is on our website at benjellis.com that people can look at. And what you will see is that our goal is to make sure that no matter where you work, you aren't stuck in a job. And the major cost for employers right now is healthcare, one of their major costs. Bankruptcies are happening because people's healthcare costs are totally out of control. Ben tells a story, and I'll say it right now. Winston Churchill has always described this way. America has always you can count on us to do the right thing after we've tried everything else. For 25 years, since Bill Clinton, we have been trying to adjust this. What works is Medicare. What can work even better is Medicare for All.
And is this aspirational, or do you really believe in your heart of hearts that this is an affordable thing? Because you mentioned a RAND study. There are, of course, any number of other studies and points of data that say, you know, this is just really expensive.
No, I think Maryland has saved hundreds of millions of dollars already in the all-payer system. And the question is, where are these dollars coming from? People cannot afford for their premiums to continue going up. They can't. And we can't as a society afford that either. And that's why we're working on this.
Susan Turnbull is my guest. She's the lieutenant governor candidate running with former NAACP President Ben Jellis on the Democratic ticket for governor. Let's go to the phones again. Dan in Charles Village, welcome to Midday with Ms. Turnbull.
Yes, thank you so much for having a wonderful program. I am very concerned about the state of the campaign. All the mainstream pollsters rate it as likely Republican as of today. The Jellis campaign has a lot of work to do, and I think we should be focusing on tactics. It's nice to get into the minutiae of policy, but I don't think the average person really gives a hoot about that. So I don't see any rallies. I live here in Baltimore. I don't see billboards. I don't see bumper stickers. I don't hear people talking about Ben Jellis, and my friends tend to be pretty political. You know, they're not maybe activists, but they're well-informed. And I'm just really concerned. The pulse of the people is that this is going to be a sleeper race, and I don't see Ben Jellis firing up the base whatsoever. And I've heard everyone else concur with me that I've discussed this with Right. And I'm really upset, and I want something to be done about this because I don't want four more years of a Republican governor.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate the call. Dan is a sentiment that I hear as well on the street from just voters who are not in politics, but as well as people in politics. They point to the money gap, Mr. Hogan with $9.5 million, and your campaign, the last report says $386,000. That seems like not enough money to run a really vital statewide campaign. They also look to the fact that the number of contributions that your campaign has received from other political campaigns. Elijah Cummings has given you some money. Jim Shea, who is one of your Democratic opponents, has given you some money. But the number of people who are stepping up with money from their coffers, putting it into yours to support the campaign, is lower than usual. You've been in politics for a long time. You know more about this than I do. But what is your sense of people's, people like Dan, I think, are not alone.
Dan, Tom and Dan, how I want to respond to this is very simply. We know when people hear our message, they like our message and they want to vote for our message. We also know that if you talk about health, people want to know why our schools have gone from first to sixth. People want to know how to deal with their health care costs rising. And what we need to do is get our message out. How are we doing that? We're doing that in pretty much an old-fashioned way, and while we may not have big rallies, we did have big rallies a few in the primary, but what we have that no other campaign has had to this extent in the state of Maryland that I'm really proud of is people knocking on doors and being engaged. I have been going places across our state. We're running a 24 jurisdiction campaign, and we are everywhere. I've been to places. Last week I was in Calvert County, where I asked the question, how many of you have been involved in a campaign before? And only half the room had ever been involved before. We have canvassed. We have 17 offices right now. We also have across the state. We also have more paid organizers, three times as many as we did 4 years ago. And we know another thing. No Republican in Maryland running for governor has ever gotten even 900,000 votes. And we know that in June, the Democratic turnout was 26% higher than it had been 4 years ago. Larry Hogan didn't win because Democrats voted for Larry Hogan. Larry Hogan won because Democrats didn't vote.
Yeah, but data is a funny thing. It might have been 26% higher. It was also just 27% overall. I mean, your campaign got 232,000 votes. So to get in the primary. Now, it was a crowded field, more crowded than the general would be. However, you're talking about five times as many votes to get to this magic million number, because we've heard Mr. Jealous talk about if I get a million votes, I can win the election. It's a matter of getting your message out. Others have said, no, it's a matter of getting your voters out. And Dan is, asking about the strategy.
It's a combination.
And is $386,000 enough to mount the so-called ground game?
We will have more than what we have right now, and we are constantly speaking to people and accepting contributions every single day and working that. But what we do have is these people. And I think that people are going to be surprised. We surprised pollsters earlier, and we are going to surprise them again. We started out a campaign running fourth in a very crowded field, and we won by 10 points over in 22 out of 24 jurisdictions. We have one of the interesting things that you mentioned is our returns from the primary. Well, in fact, we had more votes than Larry Hogan did in the primary, and we only had 40% of the Democrats. So it really is about getting our voters out. And I am confident our campaign manager is someone who is an expert in our state. He did that in 2010 when he did it for the DREAM Act. Ben and I are organizers. That's what we do.
Travis Tazelar. Yeah.
Ben and I are organizers. That's what we do. We are committed to hearing the voices of people and making sure that we're as transparent as possible and getting our message across.
When Andrew Gillum, another African-American running for governor of another important state, Florida, won his primary unexpectedly, he said they had the money, we had the votes, or we had the voters. But there are people, so, I mean, I guess what you're suggesting is something of a new paradigm, because there are Democrats in the state who say, look, the Republican Governors Association just spent $2.2 million running very negative ads. Now, you can talk about the validity and the verisimilitude of those ads, and sure, they were misleading. It's not the first misleading political ad that's ever happened in the world. But they didn't see the Jealous campaign responding to the ads. You're saying that responding to the ads is less of a priority than getting people, you know, going door to door and getting a message out. When you talk about getting the message out, Mr. Hogan is doing it by these huge television buys that he himself is doing, as well as people who support him.
Right, and he's doing negative television buys because obviously he knows that he's in trouble. He's in trouble because our schools have gone from first to sixth. Our state people are not feeling as if they are in a better place than they were 4 years ago. And he knows that we that our healthcare costs are going up. He knows all those things, and that's why he continuously has to run negative campaign ads. What we're going to be doing is running a positive campaign. And what we've seen, the races that you're talking about across the country have shown us, 2018, you have to focus on your voters. You have to focus on people who are engaged and want to be engaged in politics, and you also want to make sure that the message does get out. We're hoping and we know that we will have a very robust campaign. We are going to continue to do what we're doing, and we know that when it comes to November 6th, that's the day we have to point to. That's the day, early vote first, and then November 6th, and it's getting our voters to the polls.
Let's go to Janet in Remington. Janet, welcome to Midday with Susan Turnbull.
Hi, how are you all? I want to recount an incident that has occurred recently. I'm a member of the Druid Hill Pool adult membership. And I swam up to the man next to me and said, hey, are you Ben Jealous's father? And he obviously is African-American. And he said, who's Ben Jealous? I asked four other people that day at the Druid Hill Park pool, city pool, are you supporting Ben Jealous? None of them knew who Ben Jealous was. I then called Ben Jealous to tell him about this situation because I don't want another 4 years of Larry Hogan. I called Ben Jealous. There's no way to connect with you all.
All right. Well, Janet, I think we get the gist of your point. Again, these are Democrats who say, you know, for whatever reason, we want a Democrat in the state house in Annapolis. We don't want a Republican, whoever it is. They would probably be opposed to any Republican, you know. But people have this sense that the campaign has not gotten fired up and taken off.
Hmm. Well, we have 17 offices. If one goes online to benjealous.com and wants to volunteer, you can click online. You could see where the offices are. We have locations, and we'll make sure that people are responded to. We have over 40 field organizers out there, and that's how we are going to be pursuing moving ahead. I'm very excited because what is so amazing is that when people do know who Ben is and when they hear our message, they're with us. And it is obvious from your caller that we need to make sure that people hear our message. So help us. Help us by volunteering. Help us by contributing to the campaign. Help us by being part of what we're doing. And we're there with you.
All right. And we will give you more opportunity to get that message out there when we come back from a break. Susan Turnbull, she is the Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor on the ticket with former NAACP President Ben Jealous. We will have more with Ms. Turnbull and more of your questions and comments when we come back. 410-662-8780. That's our phone number, our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we are spending the hour with Susan Turnbull. She is a longtime Democratic activist and organizer, and she's running for lieutenant governor as Ben Jealous's running mate. If the Jealous-Turnbull ticket is elected, Mr. Jealous would be the state's first African-American governor, and Susan Turnbull would be the only woman to currently hold statewide office. This is part of our series of conversations with the candidates. Our series continues Friday with former Delegate John Olszewski Jr. He's the Democratic candidate for Baltimore County Executive. And next week, Ben Jealous will be here on Tuesday. And on Wednesday, Maryland Insurance Commissioner Al Redmer will join me. He's the Republican candidate for Baltimore County Executive. If you have a question or a comment for Susan Turnbull, you are welcome to join us at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR, and to catch us on Facebook, come to the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. Susan Turnbull, let me ask you about the sort of nationalization of this race. I mean, we've heard that the race in Georgia, where Stacey Abrams, an African-American woman, Andrew Gillum in Florida, we talked about him, and other gubernatorial races, in addition to the Congress and the Senate, are referendums on Donald Trump. How is a gubernatorial election, in our state or any state for that matter, a referendum on Mr. Trump? It's one thing to say, okay, if you oppose Mr. Trump, then it's important for Democrats to take control of the House of Representatives, perhaps even the Senate. But the state houses, you know, aren't really that directly affected by Donald Trump. How is a vote for Ben Jealous, or is a vote for Ben Jealous and for you, an expression of dissatisfaction with the current presidential administration?
Well, Ben sort of jokes, because basically, one is, what is the best way to raise Donald Trump's blood pressure? Send a civil rights leader to the governor's mansion. And that is for a couple of reasons. Number one, we've been watching the Supreme Court hearings in the last nomination hearings in the last week. And what we know in Maryland is that the next governor is going to appoint 5 out of 7 justices of our Supreme Court, which is called the Court of Appeals. Who do you want? Do you want a civil rights leader to appoint the judges? Or do you want a Republican who is giving you an opportunity to have a field team for Donald Trump? Is that what you want? And I think that's one of the things that people are going to be looking at. It's also the case is that in 2010, there's going to be redistricting and census and 2020. And what we need to do is make sure that our state is as representative of the state as it should be, that we have diversity, that we have. And right now we have 7 Democrats and 1 Republican, and that could easily go with redistricting to a totally different vantage point, a totally different place with 4 and 4. We can't afford that. And lastly,
so you would be happy with continuing the sort of gerrymandered districts that we currently have?
I think we can do better than what we have. There's no question about that. But I also think that what we don't want to do is gerrymander it the other way, which is what could happen. What is really important, I think, is that the issues that are in our election in 2018 is setting the table for 2020. And there is a big difference whether we do focus and put all of our effort into this, into schools, making sure that our schools are fully funded, that referendum one, which would be the lockbox, gets passed so that the casino money goes back into our schools. What we want to do is make sure that we have the best schools. What we want to do is make sure that we have healthcare on the forefront. And we need to move our economy. And we have a businessman named Ben Jealous who can do that.
Respond for me, if you will, to the contention that these aspirations for universal health care, for debt-free or even free college tuition, for education, K through 12 education that, you know, may have a price tag if the Kerwin Commission ever gets around to issuing their report, that is very, very high. Folks say simply it's too expensive. These are all lovely things, but it just costs too much. There is a real concern among moderates of both parties that the price tag just doesn't compute.
Well, I'll tell you, Ben's been a venture capitalist, and as the former CEO of a national organization, he knows about budgeting, and he knows that what we need to do is invest in the beginning, invest at the start to get reap rewards at the end. And what you have to do is, and what we both have learned, is that you need good management, you need common sense, and you need the courage to get big things done. We've put a proposal out. We have shown on our website and in everything we've proposed how you pay for it. And people can view those. And that is really important to recognize. But what we need to know is that what people need to understand is that you need experienced management, running large-scale organizations, understanding what budgeting can or cannot do, and that you have to make that, you have to take that leap. That leap is not a big leap. We know that spending more on incarceration has meant less on higher education, and we want to flip that. We want to change that. We know that our schools have fallen from first to sixth, and we can do something about that by doing things with universal pre-K, making sure that teachers are paid adequately and appropriately, making sure that all educators have a living wage. We can do that, and we must. It is the responsibility to have the courage to build on progress we have made through our all-payer system for healthcare, so that people can't and won't have to deal with the issues of their premiums going up 120% in the years that Larry Hogan has been governor.
Will taxes go up?
The only taxes that we're talking about, actually, we're talking about bringing taxes down for everyone by dropping our sales tax by 25 cents to 5.75 from 6 point, which we think will be a stimulus to our economy. And look, all of us pick up cups of coffee every day and we're paying tax. We buy clothes, we buy books, we buy food. We are paying taxes on things all day long, and that putting more dollars in people's individual pockets is going to help them. The only other taxes that we're talking about is potentially taxing marijuana, legalizing it, regulating it, and that would provide significant funding for things that we want to do.
But you're also talking about a 1%,
we're talking 1%
income tax on people who are at the higher end of the income spectrum.
Well, it's not the higher end. It's the top 1%.
We already have a number of people who are very wealthy who spend 6 months and a day living in Florida or living in Colorado or something like that to avoid paying Maryland sales tax. There are people at that level of wealth. And again, it's not millions and millions of people, but it's hundreds of thousands of people who do pay a lot of taxes who say Maryland's just too expensive to live. Businesses complain it's too expensive to do business. What do you think?
I think that, first of all, those are two very, very separate things. Mm-hmm. I think that we have to address our business climate. Our business climate is abysmal right now. Larry Hogan has been here the only governor in Maryland's history who has lost a Fortune 500 company when we lost Discovery in Montgomery County, partially because he didn't even return their phone calls. That's number one. Our wages are stagnant. People's everyday dollars in their pocket, and we're talking most most Marylanders, 99% of Marylanders, where what you have is that their average earnings in Virginia went up $8,000 last year. In Maryland, $450.
And what's government's capacity to flip that narrative?
Government's is to level the playing field for small businesses so that you do tax out of state businesses that are doing business here in Maryland. I know that Controller Franchot has a regulatory action right now to collect sales tax from online retailers. That was the result of a Supreme Court decision that are allowing them to do that. We want to look to close the carried interest loophole that hedge fund managers use to avoid paying taxes so that they pay less taxes than their secretaries and others in their offices. We want to make sure that investment income is for small businesses and working people. And we want to change the regulations to make us much more business friendly than we currently are.
Can you give me an example of the kind of regulation
that's onerous? Here's the kind of regulation. In certain places, what you have is when people are filing online or filing for permits and stuff in their own businesses, sometimes they have to spend $1,000 because they're going to an accountant to fill out the forms because the forms are too difficult. Where in Virginia, they can just go online, push a button, and it costs them $75. Every year that happens, particularly for people who have home-based small businesses.
You have an email from Philip that says the strategy, I guess he means the campaign strategy that you and Mr. Jealous are employing, is very pointed and doesn't waste money on television. The people who need to be reached won't be convinced by television. So you've got a high five there from Philip. But we've just got a couple minutes left here. Respond briefly, if you would, to the voter who says, you know, a bifurcation of political parties between the state house and the governor's mansion isn't a bad idea. Two-party rule is a good thing. It's a check and balance. The Democrats are making that very argument when it comes to Donald Trump. You know, if we had a Democratic Senate, perhaps, or Congress, it serves as a check and balance to a president. Why shouldn't there be a check and balance here in Maryland?
I think that the notion of checks and balances is an important notion. On the other hand, what Larry Hogan would like to do, in fact, is to make it so that he doesn't have a veto-proof majority, because he likes vetoing legislation, and he's running away from that. He has vetoed more bills than we've seen in maybe ever in the state of Maryland, and he wants his legislation to go forward. We could have in Maryland Chris Christie 2.0 very, very easily. And there's a lot at stake right now. At stake is the direction we want to go. We want to make sure our schools go back to first. We want to make sure that the environment is protected. We want to make sure that people have health care.
Susan Turnbull, she's a Democrat. She's running for lieutenant governor. She and former NAACP President Ben Jealous are running against the Republican nominees, Governor Larry Hogan and Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford. It's been a delight to meet you. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow, veteran White House reporter April Ryan joins me to talk about her new book. It's called Under Fire, Reporting from the Front Lines of the Trump White House. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Dancing at Lunasa, the new show at the Everyman Theater here in Baltimore. Lunch today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street over in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. You can find them online at dangerouspiesbalt.com. I'm Tom Hall. On behalf of the entire Midday team, thanks for joining us. Here and Now is on the way after a break for the news at the top of the hour, so stay tuned and have a great day.